Welcome to our show, Geeks Are Wired, where we talk about video games, movies, TV, comic books, technology, and TLDR, the Internet of Things. And this week, we have the podcast left. We'll go this round. Why not? Alex!
Usually at the end. We're going out of order. Wasn't ready for it.
I know.
My world
just keep going.
Just keep going.
All right. Keep going. I got nothing.
Ted. Hi.
Hello, Bill.
Good Ted.
Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi, Bill.
This is usually how awkward it gets. And Jordan.
Salutations, Bill.
Salutation.
Very classy.
I know.
I try to aim high.
Those polysyllabics, man. Like me look bad with my high. Gosh.
I need a monocle now. And our guest, Jason Brubaker.
Hello. I just rolled in off the street.
Yeah.
That's good. It's starting to rain out there, so it's a good time for you to come in.
We may lose power during the middle of the podcast. We'll just have to kind of cut and paste it back together somehow. Hopefully make it sort of work. That's my job, right?
Yeah, we'll fix and post.
We just talk into the little things.
Oh, wait, I thought you guys were imaginary. Oh, no.
It might be a much more interesting podcast if we were imaginary, because it'd just be Bill, like, laughing every once in a while, and then be like, yeah. Oh, and don't forget the... Oh, exactly. That, and then, like, just long periods of silence. That I'd listen to that podcast. I totally would.
Well, I know some people who do, so...
Seems like an almost perfect segue into Mr. Robot trailer.
Okay, but, let's do that.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Robot is a USA show that is a little bit of a spoiler because they're getting ready to start season two. I kind of feel like it's a cross between Hackers and Fight Club.
Yeah.
So, he decides to hack the entire system, bring it all down, because his dad is leading this giant hacker organization, but his dad's actually been dead for like 20 years and it's all in his head.
Yeah, it is Christian Slater reviving his career.
Wait, so, that's Christian Slater as Mr. Robot? I haven't seen it.
No, he's Mr. Robot's dad.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Fair enough.
All I think of is like the Commodore 64 game, Mr. Robot. Uh-huh. That's all I can. That's the only thing that comes to my mind.
The text is kind of like that. It has it. And yet,
okay. So I loved that game, by the way.
Yeah? I'm glad you know what Commodore 64 is.
Oh, I just
remember the King's Quest games.
Oh, yeah.
Commodore.
All the Sierra ones. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
These were the... Does Sierra make games anymore like that? Like,
yes.
Do they?
I don't know. I saw something not too long ago. They had this... Oh, no, on the Xbox. They have a giant Sierra games package. They just were selling on the Xbox.
That's not making new games. The last
they modernized them.
The adventure type games. That's the genre. It's the adventure games, which I just loved them all.
I know they're great.
Day of the Tentacle was one of my favorite series. Also, Monkey Island.
They just did a re-release of.
Yeah, I saw that.
I haven't played it yet, but Monkey Island and
Day of the Tentacle. Awesome stuff.
LucasArts.
So, Sam and Max, I think it was called. They did a couple years back. They did a subscription based where you get a new episode every so often, but that was back in my poor days where I couldn't afford such frivolities.
I think that was Telltale, actually, the ones that are making The Walking Dead serial games, episodic games, I mean.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I loved me some adventure games back in the day, though.
Yeah, I will always favor Realms of the Haunting. It wasn't precisely an adventure game, but it was one of those FMV ones. Like, they had the... whoa, it is really raining out there.
Right next to the window and everything.
Yeah, but the games in the 90s, they were super great. And late 80s, so...
And the extra ambiance provided by Mother Nature. You're welcome. Yeah. It's like we're doing the podcast in a haunted house this week.
Ooh.
Or trailer, as the case may be.
But yeah, that was a digression there.
Sorry. That was all my fault.
No, that is completely normal.
Let me do this. By the way, what is your favorite old school game?
Well, Nintendo game would be Mega Man 2.
Yeah.
Got a friend over here.
I don't know. Check out his
You're
phone.
In friendly company.
You got to show him the back of your phone.
Oh, yeah. The back of my phone is Mario buying mushrooms from Toad in an alley.
That's awesome.
That's how Mario gets his fix.
Yep.
Now Alex has a big old Mega Man Afghan in his basement that your wife made that for
you,
did she not?
Yes, she did. Yeah. She did. Cool. Supposed to be a graduation present turned into a Christmas present because it took a long time.
It's huge. I can understand. It's pretty awesome.
Was it a Christmas present that turned into a birthday present 3 years later? Or no?
Something like that.
Oh, okay.
That
and Alex, didn't you recently acquire a majestic Mega Man statue?
Yes.
Yeah, indeed.
It's I'm definitely the Mega Man hoarder.
Wow. I know. I kind of missed the headphones.
Yeah.
You used to have Mega
Man.
You
touched
them. Actually, I was the only who didn't.
Somebody touched them. I can't bring them anymore.
Technically, the person that's here is not here. Is the one who touched
them. She can't touch them now where they are.
Oh.
Yeah, I keep them from her. She can't go near them.
Seems
keep her
reasonable.
Filthy mitts off of them. Her filthy
mitts. He would wear them, but
mitts.
Yeah, no fingerprints.
So. As far as old school consoles go, NES, you were a Nintendo person.
I love Nintendo,
what
yeah. Yeah. Commodore 64 and then Nintendo.
Yeah.
Yep.
The Atari.
I never had one.
Competed with the Commodore a little bit, but it was a little earlier.
Yeah.
That was back before they really realized that they could make money just churning out consoles. So.
Atari did have the best game ever.
E.T.? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was so good. They filled a landfill with them.
That's right. They wanted to give Mother Earth its bounty.
What was it? I spent a lot of time playing. I played the Star Wars game with it, which was a lot of fun. It looked just like Defender, but it was with the AT-ATs instead, which was nice.
Yeah.
You had to hit them in just the right spot. And, lots of fun.
Was it what was that? Is that for the Commodore or
for the Atari?
Atari.
Well, okay, that's the other thing. Also, a lot of these games that came out on Nintendo and Atari back then too did come out on the Commodore.
Right.
It was like nowadays it comes out on everything.
Right.
Well, and I think software copyright laws were a lot more loose than they are now. It was a lot less tied down.
It was also easier to pirate it. Maybe now it's a little bit with the codes and
you know. It was new technology, so the lawmakers didn't understand how to do anything about it, so they just didn't do anything. I mean, they're finally figuring out video games, you know. They'll figure out the internet in the next 10 years or so.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Oh, come on. The joke about Batman and Robin being gay was Congress going, comic books are bad. Comic books will make you gay. Video games will make you kill people. What else we got? It's really bad for you.
The internet will make you an introvert.
Yes.
The internet does make you an introvert.
I know there's a lot of people here. Oh, wait, I forgot. You're all imaginary.
Listening to podcasts will make you deaf.
Yeah. Oh.
Except for this one.
Yeah.
Yes.
You're safe with this one.
Yeah.
The other ones, don't listen to the other ones. In fact, just go back and download all the old ones and listen to this one.
Well, actually,
exclusively.
With that, I forgot. This is episode 200.
Oh, is it?
Hey,
yes.
How about that?
We have
double lot.
We have made it to almost 4 years.
Happy tidings, Bill. That's an accomplishment.
I know.
Oh, you've been there every episode.
And we're finally on Google. Google Play. Google Play finally decided to do podcasts.
Oh, nice.
Hmm.
Is that why the listenership dropped?
No, actually, literally just added it. Like, this is the first officially posted one to Google.
So this is the 200th episode and the first one on Google. That's
well, not the official, because they had the last 20.
Well, the first new one.
Yeah, this is the first new one, yeah. Because it was a couple days after the last one posted.
It's a red letter day.
I don't know. So, yay. So we're we have no segregation. We're on iTunes and Google.
And speaking of celebration, that's a perfect opportunity to reseg into Mr. Robot, season 2. Yeah, trailer.
About.
Yeah, nice. So, have you watched it, Bill?
Season 2? No. But the trailer, yes.
I haven't seen it yet. Is it good?
Yeah. You saw it. You guys saw it. Didn't you guys watch it?
I don't have cable. And I'm too lazy to set up my antenna because Netflix is typically good enough for it.
Mr. Robot airs on, it's on USA's,
No, you know what? Last year when Mr. Robot was coming out and I was like, this sounds really cool. I want to go check it out. I tried to go watch it there. I couldn't. Maybe I'm too dumb to and I don't deserve to. But
well, USA,
it wasn't available streaming. You had to pay for it or sign in with your cable. provider's information in order to.
Also, they took
it
off of, for free viewing.
Yeah, it might. Oh, that's a bummer. I mean, it might be there now. I don't know. I haven't looked. But,
Ted, you were never tempted to.
Oh, USA's. Yeah, no, USA's not even. I need a cable anyways.
You weren't tempted to raise the flag.
No, I've always said.
I always said.
You know, I pirated a lot of stuff back when I was poor, but I got a job, a college degree, and a job. And I got enough money to pay for the stuff, so I'll stop pirating it. That just means I go without. That's all right.
And this is not an endorsement of pirating. It's very bad, folks. Do not do it.
Yeah, don't pirate this podcast.
Yeah, don't pirate it.
No, we're free anyways.
But still don't pirate it. We know that we need those hits.
We don't charge people to listen to it. So you could pirate it.
Why do we keep coming back? Every time you give me that CD.
Wait, where's this money going? I need the money.
You're charging me? Why?
I'm only
it's
you.
Free?
It's you and
there
your...
goes my dreams of royalties.
Yeah.
But yeah, I am. When does the season start?
I had that and I lost it
because I did watch Mr. Robot season 1 and I enjoyed it. It was a really entertaining show.
So Psych was on USA, right?
Haven't seen Psych.
No, but it was on USA.
Yes.
And so that means the Mr. Robot will probably eventually be on Netflix because they usually, Netflix does like networks. So they had like Stars for a while, and that's when you saw all the Disney stuff on there.
Yeah.
Stars and Disney had some affiliation.
Well, that is really nice when they had Stars, but Stars, when they renegotiated their contract, they just demanded way too much of them.
That seems to happen a lot.
Yeah, it is unfortunate.
So, okay.
But I guess they're...
Minions?
No. July 13th.
July 13th.
July 13th.
Okay. That's something to look forward to.
I have until July 13th to find someone with cable.
Well, that'll happen. Or you can always find some... I know you're not approval of the clandestine.
I won't even watch it. I just won't. Nope.
Okay.
I'll find a way to get it legally for free.
You should be.
You'll let somebody else pay for it.
Yes.
But, yeah, you should be commended, Ted, for your doughty morals.
Well, I don't know about
They're
that.
Unshakable.
But no, it's... shows a lot of the aftermath. Like, so the hacking happened. He took down the system. He took down the evil corporation that was in his head, because the evil corp had a name, but he was against it.
Right.
And it was taken down. So it's kind of spoilers for season 1. But now it's the aftermath.
Mm.
So Mr. Robot is actually the only product that has gotten me to click on a banner ad in the last 4 years. The other night, I saw the ad for it, and it was like, the revolution is near, or something like that. I'm like, what the heck is that? I don't know what they're advertising. So I clicked on it, and then it was like watchmrrobot.com or something like that. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
When the revolution
and I know happens, I want to see it. So
when the revolution happens, they're going to get banner ads. That's going to be the first thing. Of course.
I was like, what is this revolution, and how can I join? Who are you revolting against?
Evil Corp?
Apparently so.
Yeah.
But I think that's the second ad for that show that I've clicked in the last couple of years. And, I mean, nothing else. So
it's good advertising, you're saying?
Yeah, they do a good job at their advertising.
Yeah. All right. We'll move along. Well, we'll move to our guest speaker. Guest host, I don't know. So, Jason, you are an artist?
Yes, I am.
So explain about you're getting a Kickstarter.
Yeah. I self-publish graphic novels, and I launch Kickstarters to fund them all, and I'm mesmerized with your computer over here. Okay.
It works both ways, so you know that you sound good, but...
Yeah, and then you space off watching it like TV.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, I launched a Kickstarter for a graphic novel I created called Cythra. It's volume 2, and it raised about $24,000 in the first 21 hours. So it was kind of a insane first day on it. And it's not my first Kickstarter, so I've built an audience over the years, but this is a new series I have, and it'll be about 6 books long. And right now it's featured on webtoons.com. It's a website that has a lot of web comics. So, but this is my attempt to fund the publication as an actual physical book and then send it out to, you know, bookstores and Amazon and all that stuff. And,
all right.
And it goes until the end of this month, actually. So
yeah, I think it's as of this moment, I was looking at like 11 more days.
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It ends the last day of this month. And if we get enough money and stretch goals, I'll be able to print the third book as well. So, but who knows if that will happen.
You won't have to do a Kickstarter for the third book.
Yeah.
It'll
just be sent to the printers and it'll be done. It'll be sitting in my garage for 6 months before I release it.
So where is this garage exactly?
It's the same place that everything else always starts up. You know, Apple started there. Microsoft started there.
We gotta find this garage. Nirvana started there, right?
Yeah. Everyone in their garage. Mm-hmm. It's the garage.
When I went house hunting, the selling factor was this huge garage that came in this house. It's true story.
Yeah.
It's like 50 foot deep, and I'm like, oh, shelves, books, and shelves everywhere. So,
yeah, that's the sign of success. Show me your garage.
How many books do you have in your garage?
Me or him?
Yeah, well, I mean, that I guess that's the sign right there.
Yeah.
Mine are all the same book, though, so that doesn't count.
Jason, I was actually at the little con in the middle of...
Nowhere.
Nowhere. Yeah, and so I heard you speak about this, but yeah. I'm sure people would like to hear a little about how you started the Kickstarter and everything and what your experience was like with that.
Well, you know, my first campaign was probably the first year I think Kickstarter was around, and so I didn't even believe it would work, and but my fans on that were following me on my website were like, you got to do it. If you do it, we'll help you, we'll back it. And so I put it on there, and sure enough, and that one raised about $12,000, and I was completely blown away, and it changed my whole perspective on self-publishing and how to do it, you know, because before Kickstarter it was like, how do you get this money? You do a credit card, or you know, you find a publisher or something. And so then over time, you know, I kept putting stuff online as a webcomic and writing how-to articles about what I'm learning, and I would grow an audience that way. And then when the second book of Remind, that was my second graphic novel, came out, I put a Kickstarter out for that, and it raised $107,000, which was insane at the time. And it was right when Kickstarter was getting their first $1 million campaigns, and so a lot of attention was on Kickstarter at that time. So I think that I attribute that to the success of that one. But it's just been amazing, and so I've continued to use it as a platform for funding my books, and I've done the Cythra campaign for the first volume, which was raised $52,000, and then this is Cythra 2. And we're at like $42,000 right now. So, and usually it jumps up a little bit on the last, you know, 3 days too. So I'm hoping to get it, you know, get it up a little higher. And, but yeah. And it's one of those things that people ask me, how do I, you know, get onto Kickstarter and fund a awesome project? And the discouraging answer I always give is, you know, start 2 years ago and build an audience by giving them stuff for free, you know, for years. So it's just, that's kind of been my strategy, but it's worked really well. I mean, it wasn't like it was my plan going in, like, I'll make a comic and then it'll be a Kickstarter, because Kickstarter didn't even exist. So it's just one of those opportunities that presented itself, you know, and I had something to throw at it. So, and I've been throwing things at it ever since.
So these are all published. You didn't go through any sort of a publishing, like you just paid someone to print all these.
Exactly. Yeah.
And which I guess has the benefit means that you work for yourself, right? Mm-hmm. You don't have to pay anybody else. But as far as what about, like right now, if I wanted to get an old copy of some old book, I could contact a publisher, and if there was enough interest in it, the publisher might renew that. But once you're done, you know, what sort of what avenues do we have to to search these things out? You know what I'm trying to say? Like how do you
like
see
how does
a
it
problem
stay?
With that?
How does it keep going?
It's kind of
there's two sides to it. A lot of self-publishers say that the biggest advantage a self-publisher has is they can always keep their books in print. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, you know, someone will make a book and they'll go to a publisher and they'll print it, but it's not one of their top five books, and so they don't reprint it. And then the publisher has the rights to this book. Mm-hmm. And you either have to buy the rights back or something, you know. And so it's a kind of a hard situation unless you're one of the top authors at a company. And so I look at it kind of like an advantage that I can, as long as I can keep putting these books out in a lot of different ways. Like I just released Remind 1 and 2 on Kindle just a couple weeks ago. So there's another avenue, and it's on Comixology, and of course it's online for free and stuff too.
So I guess that makes it a lot easier to publish. There's no cost to you to for someone to download it on Kindle.
For the digital, definitely. I always want to keep my stuff in print though, you know, and that has proven to be a difficult situation to try to figure out how to do it. Like for instance, my stretch goals in this current campaign are to print soft cover versions of Remind 1 and 2, which is my old graphic novel, which is the second one's out of print now. And so I need to be a little more wise with how I save my money from the book sales in the future. And that's one of the things I'm learning as I'm growing is, you know, just a portion of everything I make, I need to put it into account for reprinting. And that's kind of, I think that's the only way I can do it, unless I just plan on keep having bigger and bigger campaigns where it's like, now let's reprint 50 old books, you know? And I don't think that's going to work. So
the reprinting of the old books can turn into a bit of a money sink.
Yeah.
If no one's aware of them, no one's actively buying them on a regular basis.
Yeah, but the thing about it that's really neat is, once you start publishing books and you keep publishing books, the best way to sell old books is publish a new book, you know? And like everything I do online is always introducing someone new to my line of books. Mm-hmm. And so new fans can buy all my stuff if they want, and whereas old fans are just buying my newest thing. So it's always growing in that way, which is an exciting part of it, you know, as long as I can keep them in stock.
I heard a story of Richard Dawkins was talking in front of people, and he's put out several books.
Yeah.
I'm sure perhaps you've heard of him, whatever. But one of the things that, like, it was almost like he was complaining about was that people would bring books for him to sign, and they were always his old books. They weren't his new books.
Okay.
He's you know, buy my new books. But it sounds like you're just as excited about people buying your old books as buying the new ones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, I look at it like in 10 years, if I can have a whole bookshelf full of books, like 10, 20 books, you know, that's passive income on all those books. Mm-hmm. It's a little stream of income from each one of those books that hopefully would be selling in the background. You know, it's not me having to physically make something and give it to someone.
Right.
You know, my audience is excited about that new thing, but the new audience has a whole bunch of stuff to dig through now, you know? And so, yeah, to me, it's great. And I mean, I will say, you know, when someone comes to me at a convention with a book that they bought, I'm like, oh, it's not a new sale. Oh, okay, I'll sign it anyway. But it's just neat that there are fans that actually, you know, hunt you down and bring their old book that they bought from you on Amazon or something.
No, I think I did that with Cythra, the biggest little con. I bought it at Kevin Bangles.
And yeah.
I was like, here, by the way.
It happens. It happens a lot now. But it's great. You know, and some people will have like the really fancy like box set that's limited edition numbered, and I'll be like, oh, you're bringing that around, it's gonna get damaged. I don't have any more of those, you know. But it's cool. It's been fun. I mean, and I mean, you guys know, but no one else probably knows that's listening. But I just started doing it full time just less than a year ago, and since moving here. And so it's kind of been a surreal experience since diving into this full time. And this, you know, I wake up and I go into the office and I work on the books. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of weird to think that that's possible.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, that's really cool. You can do that. And
yeah.
I admit I might have a little more issue going like, all right, I have to do this day in and day out.
Yeah. Know. Well, it's exciting. And there are days when I'm like, oh, how am I going to have a vacation sometime? You know, I got to keep producing this stuff. But, you know, because like Webtoons, the company that I put it online through, I have a contract with them where I have to deliver something every week to them.
Oh.
And so it really keeps me in my seat, like focused.
Mm-hmm.
And, so it's good, but you know, I'm really itching to take a break from it.
Yeah. So you might have to like prep a few extra in advance.
Yeah. I actually have a break scheduled. So after the third book is online, I'm going to try to take like 3 months break from Webtoons.
Right.
I'll be doing other things I'll probably be working on the next books and, you know, random other things to get way ahead of schedule for mm-hmm. when it launches again. But
right.
Yeah.
What brought you into being an artist and into drawing all that?
Oh, I just always loved to do it. I never remember not loving to draw and tell stories. And, you know, my mom has a box full of stapled together little books that are crayon drawings, you know, and she would transcribe what I would say
nice.
So that, you know, it could actually have words that you could read, you know, and just boxes and boxes full of books. And I thought when I was a kid, I was like, well, obviously I would just want to be an artist.
Mm-hmm.
But as I grew older and got art jobs, I realized being the artist isn't the thing that I really wanted to do. It was creating narratives that mm-hmm. with my art. And that's the kind of artists I loved as a kid, you know, like all the newspaper type funnies. Those are all artists that just do their own thing, you know. It's not like you go into Disney and have to draw the Disney style.
Yeah.
You know? Or, you know, comic books were a great influence because it was all these artists that just did their style. And mm-hmm. a lot of times they would write their stories, even if it was Spider-Man, you know. They would write it and draw it in their way. Mm-hmm. And so that was always so exciting to me to think that you could do that sort of thing. So when I started getting a lot of jobs and it was just like, all right, draw a Taco Bell commercial. I'm like, oh, this, you know, this, I would rather go work construction or something, you know, this is just, it's destroying my excitement for, you know, drawing.
And the storytelling and everything.
Yeah. Yeah. So
did you find, that when you were doing that sort of work, that when you'd come home at the end of the day, you just didn't have any energy left to do your own thing?
Totally. I would, there was, the worst was when I would do storyboards, and that was my first like real professional job in LA. I did it for about 6 years, had an agency that would send me out on jobs every day, and it was just mentally draining. It was just like, I would get home and I just didn't want to do any, I didn't want to look at any a piece of paper or nothing, you know. I just wanted to go out and sit outside and look at something. look at the tree or something, you know, because it was like, well, in storyboards, it's so demanding. I thought it was mentally draining because you're taking a script and you're trying to visualize it and then break it down so that people can understand it from shot to shot. So you're kind of directing it, you know, and it's a lot of thought going into these drawings, telling this narrative. But, you know, like, it's always these really stupid narratives, like a Taco Bell commercial again. And it's like, oh, you know. But I did learn a ton from that because I would work with a different director every day, practically, you know. And, you know, every director has a different way of telling stories. And so you would learn all these different tricks, you know, and you would learn, it'd be like just going to school, like really hardcore school to just learn all this mm-hmm. stuff, but and just doing it every day. And then the same thing when I worked at DreamWorks, that was the last job I had in LA. It was like 7 years of just color theory training, I felt, you know. And that was the most exciting part of these jobs, is like what I can learn from it and then apply to my own thing.
Right.
But then back to the storyboarding, it would be so draining that, I would never work on my own thing when I would get home. You know, I'd have to, like, I would actually take vacations. I would book a vacation for, like, a month and a half and then I'd work on my own projects for that time, and then I'd go back into work. You know, save up more money, then book another vacation where I'd work on my own thing. That's how I did it.
I think I noticed the same thing. I went to college for computer science and do programming and whatnot, and While I was going to school, I had all this extra energy and focus to just to just do this stuff. So I'm like, I'm going to write my own game, and I was going for it gung ho. And then as soon as I got a job, you know, and I'm working 8 hours a day doing this programming stuff, and it's fun and engaging, and I like it. And it's not like I don't like to program anymore, because I do it all day and I enjoy it. But like, I go home and I just don't want to see any more code.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
So I kind of wondered if that was another, you know, like thing. Yeah. Like, people say, you know, do what you love.
Yeah.
And then you'll never work a day in your life. But it kind of sounds like that's the experience you had. You went into the thing that you loved, but you found out what you love wasn't really what you loved. It was something else.
Yeah. And so. and my strategy around that problem, once I got into DreamWorks, and I was like, and I started putting my first comic online, and people started liking it. And so I was like, I need to figure out how to keep doing this. And what I ended up doing was, I'd get up really early in the morning and work on my book for a couple hours before I'd go to work. And so I was like wide awake, I was excited, and kids weren't still in bed, you know, so no distractions. And I would work on this, and then I'd go into work, and I'd actually be really excited. I'd be more energetic all day, because I'm like, I got the thing done that I wanted to get done, and I don't care about all this, but I'll do it, and then go home and go to sleep, you know.
That's really interesting. So where I had been, I've always said, you know, I'm going to go home, I'm going to like write out this class, or I'm going to, you know, create this section of the code. I'm going to get this thing working. And then I get home and I'm like, I could just go play Ark right now.
Yeah.
I could play somebody else's program.
Yeah, exactly. you were doing it ahead of time so that you had the energy for it. That actually makes a lot of sense.
I've known a lot of artists since I've been doing that have tried it, and a lot of people, it seems like, find a lot of success with it. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, are you motivated enough to want to get up early, you know? And right now I'm not. I thought I could keep doing that, but now,
but then, like, have your afternoons even more, like, could be done at noon, and like, I'm out.
Yeah, but now I'm like, oh, I got all day to, you know, I'll sleep until I, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But, you know, but if I was still in a full-time job doing something else, like, I think that would be my strategy still, because it really worked, and it even made the job funner and more exciting, because you can go and talk to everyone about what you're doing. And
I mean for me, when I do something, like when I'm coding on something, and even at work when I'm coding on something and like it's not working and it finally does work, like, I get really excited about that, and I get a lot of energy out of that. So I could see how, you know, doing something that you enjoy like that in the morning would actually boost you up, lift you up, and get you going. But
you mentioned earlier that you took a lot of inspiration from newspaper comics, and also comic books. Are there any particular authors or artists that inspired you?
Yeah. Well, when I was really young, you know, I liked the, you know, Garfield, Jim Davis, and The Far Side, and Calvin and Hobbes, Bill Watterson. Those were kind of like the people I wanted to imitate, you know? And, then I got a little older in junior high. I started getting into like Ninja Turtles, like the comics, and, stuff like all the guys that formed Image Comics when it first started, like Todd McFarlane and Eric Larson and Jim Lee and, Sam Keith, and all those guys were just kind of like, it was like, this is amazing. The artists are rising up and making their own thing, you know. It was like really exciting. And and that's when I kind of started finding out about some like Japanese animation, like Akira. And so that was very influential. I was like, wow, animation for grown-ups. This is amazing, you know. And so, and then I started, after I moved to LA, I started learning more about like Miyazaki. You know, Spirited Away and Princess Mononoke. I actually saw Princess Mononoke in the theater when it first came out here, and I had no idea what it was. this girl was like, hey, come see this movie with me. I'm like, all right. And then I was like, I don't know what this is. What's going on? But then later I was like, I can't believe I watched that in the theater.
Yeah.
After I, you know, 2 years later, after I realized I want to collect everything this guy's done. So
it is unfortunate. We did a podcast recently, kind of bemoaning the limited release of Hayao Miyazaki. Like, his films don't receive the appropriate appreciation.
You know, it's kind of funny, too. I did my honeymoon in Japan, and one of the things we wanted to do, we saw that there was a museum, right? Just a Studio Ghibli museum, right? Where you could go there and you could see all that stuff. And so we were like, well, things we want to do while in Japan, and that was like a big one. And then we go there, we like looked online how to get the tickets, and it looked like it was going to be easier when we were in Japan. So we were like, okay, we get up in the morning, we're like, we're going to go there today. And we go to the machine, and it's all in Japanese, so we had to get someone at the counter to like help us like sign, you know, get the tickets. And we're looking and we're like, yeah, that one, because we, you know, we know the characters, we don't know the Japanese characters, but we know the people, right? You know, and I was like, oh no, it's sold out for the next like 6 months.
Really?
Like, oh my gosh. So if you're gonna go to Japan and you wanna see that, you need to book ahead of time, like well ahead of time.
The Miyazaki is very popular.
Yeah.
You really have to cross your fingers too, because I believe he's retired, essentially.
Yeah but I mean it's a museum, just it's not, there's people going there all the time and everything. So but yeah, like I think I assumed, because so few people here were super hardcore about it or anything, that it would be kind of be the same way there, and it's not. I mean it's super popular.
Yeah.
And so yeah, it's, I wish more people would like it here so that we could get more high quality stuff.
I may be misremembering, but I recall, I think that Princess Mononoke came out in that 1997 or something like that. But
sounds about right.
Yeah, roughly concurrent to Titanic.
That was a year after I moved to LA, so that'd be about right.
Yeah, and so I probably am remembering this correctly, but Titanic was worldwide number one, except in Japan, where that honor was...
Princess Mononoke.
Good for Princess Mononoke.
Indeed. It deserved it. I love it.
I think it's a better movie, actually.
Princess Mononoke.
Absolutely. No disagreement from me.
I've seen Titanic once, and Princess Mononoke, I don't know how many times.
I'm not even sure if I've actually seen all of Titanic. I mean, I've like seen in sections.
I contributed one ticket sale, yes.
Oh, okay. I didn't even do that much. I was like, okay.
Yeah, my wife drug me there like 4 or 5 different times.
Yeah,
this is an incredibly watchable.
We're divorced now, though.
So that's it.
Yeah. Have you guys read Nausicaa, Valley of the Wind? Like, there's the anime, but
I haven't read it.
I just got that box set 2 months ago or something.
Really?
Yeah.
You should.
It's amazing. It's completely different looking than the movie.
Yeah, he wrote it over a period of, I think, 6 or 8 years.
I think the library has the... I don't know if it's an omnibus or like the first trade paperback or what, but it's a thick one. It's a real big one.
Yeah. The box set has two, and they're about an inch a half thick. Yeah, it's a fat thing.
Yeah.
You can crush a small animal under it. It's a big collector's edition.
Yeah.
No, at least you realize you're talking to a microphone. Usually you're like, it's this big, and the listeners cannot see this. You're like, it's this, an inch and a half thick each.
No, it's best to leave it to the imagination. And H.P. Lovecraft said, I can't describe any scary thing, anything scarier than the readers can delve up in their own imaginations. True. So he was a big fan of leaving the monster kind of nondescript but scary seeming.
He was also a big fan of having the person in imminent danger say, and I'm still writing in my journal. There's terror upon me. I don't know why I'm writing in my journal, but I must continue.
I think it was really scary back then, and now we've got all this fancy technology to show people that it's not as scary.
But people can also, like video diaries or stuff like that nowadays. So somebody could actually, like the captain's log that they're busting through the door. Sorry, we got to shut this off. Hope I didn't shut it off fast enough.
Blair Witch. Or,
I had a question about your Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you'd been a little bit ramped up before you started your Kickstarter. And when I go to the credits for any of your books, I notice there's other names in there.
Uh-huh.
So when you started out with self-publishing, were you already planning to self-publish before Kickstarter, or did the team come together after you started self-publishing? Like, how did you coordinate that with your helpers?
I didn't know how I would get stuff published when I first started. I guess my thought was, you know, I'll find an agent, and the agent will get it in front of this book company, and then I'll get a big book deal, and it'll be great because they'll see my art, and no big deal, you know. And you know, it just didn't work that way. You know, like, people don't want to give you a shot unless they see that you've proved it before, you know. So I was like, well, I guess I'll try putting it online and just seeing what happens. And sure enough, you know, people, an audience starts growing from that, putting it online as a webcomic. And it was through that I started getting connected with a lot of people who were specialized in some field, but they loved my comic. And so, like, for instance, my designer, he would comment a lot. And finally, I just was like, this guy's a really good designer, and he loves this, obviously. So I'm going to just see if he wants to help me design the book, because he knows how to do it. And I tried to do a comic, and it failed miserably, even though it should be really simple. And this graphic novel that I have that has all these different, you know, cloth binding and stamp, foil stamping, it's like, there's no way I'll get this right the first time. So anyway, I asked him, and he was just like, yeah, I would love to do it. And so... And so a lot of the connections were from fans. And another example is this one lady in Germany was like, hey, I want to translate it into German. I was like, okay. Nice. And so she just started working on it, and she would recreate the art that had German fonts. And she got through the whole first book, and she's like, here, check it out. And I'm like, this is amazing. Like, I don't know what to do with it, but it's awesome.
How did you verify that? Sorry to interrupt, but how did you verify the integrity of the language?
I just
hope for the best.
I was like, it's a fan translation. This is awesome. And
ein Schnitzel mit Pommes frites?
Yeah.
Looks good to me.
And so time went on, and she's like, well, I could try shopping this around to publishers here. I was like, okay, sure. And then another German friend of mine said, hey, my publisher kind of would like to publish Remind. I'm like, well, I have a fan translated version, maybe you could use it. And so she sent them the translation. They're like, yeah, this looks good. And they just edited it a little bit, and it actually was released just a couple months ago, and nice. A full-on German version. And so,
not that one.
Yeah, not that.
He brought some books for everyone to look at.
So a lot of it is just the passionate fans that have read it for free online that are kind of like, yes, I will be a part of this. Please let me be a part of it, you know. And my editor, he was actually a longtime friend. He grew up here, Jeremy Barlow, and he worked at Dark Horse Comics for a while. We went to conventions back in the day in the 90s.
Awesome.
And so he's really good. Obviously, he wrote Star Wars comics. I mean, how good do you need to be? Yeah. Pretty good, probably, you know? And so he's just helped me edit all my stuff. And it's just really fun working with him, because half the time I'm like, I don't know what to do here. I need to convey this emotion. He'll just be like, write up something. And I'll be like, perfect, yeah, you know? Nice. So he's really been helping a lot. Let's see, who else is in there? I don't know who else is in here. Oh, so this is interesting. You guys probably know Sam Keith. I got a pinup from Sam Keith and a quote on the back of the first book. And it's because he just emailed me because he saw my webcomic. He was like, this is great color work. I'm a big fan. And I'm like, wait, is this the Sam Keith? I'm your fan. It's not the other way around.
Yeah, that doesn't go that way.
Yeah. So again, it was just putting it online for free and just, you know, like, it attracts people somehow. And once that audience starts growing and communicating, it's amazing what happens from that. You know, I mean, you guys probably experienced that with just a podcast, you know, in some ways.
So. It's had its ups and downs. We've been doing it for 4 years, but it's had, you know, it's been around.
I started an old podcast and then gave it to someone, and then I started another one. So I'm not near 200 episodes in.
It's like a sourdough starter. It's a podcast. You start it, you give it to them.
If anyone's interested, it's Coffee Table Comics Podcast.
Okay. Well, so, then.
Yeah, it's. I just talked to other comic artists who are also trying to get into, or who are working in comics, and we kind of discuss what our strategies are and try to figure out how to move forward. So
it seems like you got a lot of benefit just by being able to get those networking opportunities ahead of time, because you knew people already. So when you needed something, you had someone you could call on.
Yeah.
So if you're a creator in like any field, you could probably, I imagine, benefit by having those connections before you start your Kickstarter, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. The very first Kickstarter, though, it was still really early. I didn't have a book done, you know, so it was still super early in the process. My designer, I contacted him, though, but then it was just kind of the fans who suggested the Kickstarter. So, again, I wouldn't have done it if I didn't put it online and the fans wouldn't have said, hey, do this, check it out. It's a thing called crowdfunding. And I'm like, it doesn't work, you know?
So I bought a lot of Kickstarters where they had just a great idea, but then just it fell apart because it was too much pressure and just like one person, or they didn't have like a group of people.
Have you guys heard of the notorious Peter Molyneux?
I know of Peter Molyneux.
Yeah, who formerly was part of Lionhead Studio. Yeah, he had a lot of controversy as far as that went. And so, yeah, it seems demanding, and unfortunately some people are not as up to it as they should be. But so it's wonderful when people do pull through. It is a success.
Yeah, I mean, it is a complete roller coaster, though. I mean, just even while the campaign's happening, it's an emotional roller coaster. You know, I got a couple people canceling their pledges today. I'm like, oh, this is a stab, you know. But anyway, but that's just what happens in the middle of the campaigns. It's always just like rocky. But the second Remind campaign, I will say that one demanded my – I tell people it demanded a piece of my soul, and I had to have a time for it to grow back. You know, I took like a year off of comics, like trying to make my own comics after that, because it was just – it was so difficult to fulfill it. And I had to get freelance jobs to pay for these extras that I threw in, and shipping cost way more than I expected it to. And, you know, it raised a lot of money, but all that money went into stuff and then even more than what I had raised. And I wanted to fulfill these promises that I gave people. And some of them were like around the world promises that cost $90 to ship something that they didn't pay $90.
Yeah, cause now there's a lot of people who have done that a few times. Yeah. They're like, if you live in the U.S., it's free shipping, or you know, it's included. Yeah. If you live outside the U.S., that's an extra $50.
Yeah, and people don't like to hear that price tag, but it's just what it costs. Now Kickstarter's pretty cool with how they give you the option of putting a shipping price on any country. Mm-hmm. So I can build that into my campaign. Before, you actually had to spell it out, like, in the tier, like, if you live in this place, add this much, you know. Mm-hmm. And this is like, oh, so complicated. And then some people don't do it, you know, so you got to somehow collect it or say, sorry, I can't ship it. But
that's gotta be the worst. You got a fan in another country, like, I'm sorry, I can't send this to you.
Yeah. And you know, most of the times I would just take the loss and just to get it to them, because they, you know, I don't want to let the fans down, but it's only the people who are like jerks, I guess, who I'm like, okay, never mind.
You know, actually raises an interesting question. I think one of the first podcasts I did, we had a discussion about what does the artist owe the fans. You remember we were talking about...
No, that was you and Joe, I think. Was it about was George and okay. Martin.
Yeah, so you start telling a story, right? Yeah. You've got the Cythra here. You've got another one coming out.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it's... I apologize for my ignorance. I haven't read them. I'm not a big comic book person. I like passive media more. but anyways, so you're writing a story as the artist and going through and writing this big epic tale of some sort, right?
Yeah.
And people are buying into it and whatnot. Do you feel that you owe the audience completion? Like, do you feel that they, my thought on the subject is that they have been paying you to write this story for, you know, however long you've been doing it.
Yeah.
You're halfway through. Do you owe the fans a completion, or do you feel, you know, they haven't paid, they've gotten what they paid for, basically.
Oh, I see. Mean, yeah. I do have a really deep sense of like, I have to make sure it ends like as good as they expected or better, you know, because, and that was really nerve-wracking when I decided to break this first series Remind into two books. And at first I was like, it was just so I could get the first one out. But then once I finished that and it was successful and people were like, you're a great writer, I was like, crap, I have all this expectation that the second one's going to just be even better and end tying up the story perfectly. And so it was really, it caused a lot of sleepless nights, you know?
Right.
And so like with Cythra, it's like, yes, I want to, I almost feel like, I feel like I'm letting people down if I wouldn't actually come follow through and finish it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because the way my books are produced, they're kind of expensive, you know, the $20 hardcover book. And so, you know, people invested a lot of money by the time they get to the end. And so, I'm always nervous about the next book that is going to be better. And right. And I can deliver more, you know, more value. And so, like, this book was kind of thin. The next one's about twice as thick.
Uh-oh.
And the next one after that is like 190 pages, which is even bigger. And so
you're gonna start maxing out that printing press.
It's gonna be like the Harry Potter books.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know. And also, you know, if I don't deliver a finished product with my story I'm on, then people aren't. Why would they buy my next story?
Right.
You know.
Right.
And I have like. You know, five stories still in me that I feel like I really want to say and right. tell. And if people are kind of like, he just started another book, you know, and it's what happened to the last one, you know,
right.
then I know people wouldn't move over to that new series,
right?
You know, unless I was working on them simultaneously, which would be impossible for me.
There's some artists. I think we were even talking about that with Wheel of Time.
Robert Jordan.
No, not Robert Jordan. New. Brendan Sanderson.
Oh, yeah, he does.
He is, like, knocking out, like, 3 to 5 novels a year.
I'm not convinced he's a human. He's actually a robot because he writes about 1 million words a year or something.
Maybe he's, like, several humans.
Maybe that's it.
There are ghostwriters, so that...
Well, he became a ghostwriter.
Yeah, James Patterson is... I think he's New York Times number one bestseller, but he doesn't write a lot of the books
under his name.
Corollary to Ted's question is, do you feel that you have to deliver the books in a timely manner?
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, you're not currently contracted to a book, but it's expected after the release of it's a continuation,
mm-hmm.
and you say, I intend to do this continuation. Do you feel that even before you begin a campaign to get the money for that book, that you have to be expeditious about producing the book?
I think it depends on the situation I'm at in life. Like when I was working full-time at DreamWorks, and I finished Remind and it demanded part of my soul, I decided with Cythra, like after I took a year off, I was like, okay, I'm going to just produce what I can comfortably produce in a year, package it up, and then sell it to the fans. And so if this series ends up being 12 volumes long, because I can only do 40 pages in a volume, then that's what I'll do. But at this point in my life, now that I'm being paid by Webtoons to sit down and work on the stuff and deliver it every week, it's kind of this, you know, like if I don't deliver it now, I won't get a paycheck, you know?
Yeah.
And so the paycheck I'm really looking forward to, though, is when I get the books published and get them out into the world, because that's to me my end goal is to have the physical books done and be able to start working on another one and having that passive income. Like I don't want to have to rely on a paycheck from a Webtoons for the rest of my life, you know? So if I'm in that stage past Webtoons where I'm just working on it and trying to get it done, that would be the ultimate point where I'd have to ask myself that question, I think. And I would probably like to get a volume of work done at least once a year, just mm-hmm. so that people keep having something to continue reading, you know?
I see.
And I don't want to stretch things out too long to where, you know, it's 12 volumes in one a year, because it's like, oh man, you know, I might die before I finish that. Who knows what's going to happen? So, I really do want to do them in a timely manner,
mm-hmm.
Just in respect to the audience so they can get it. And if I could just do a book in a story all in at once and get it out there the way I wanted it, then I would. But you know, I like these big breathing landscapes and focusing on the art. You know, like a lot of my stuff is spreads, it's full of spreads, and I do that because that's the kind of book I want to see.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not just like jamming story into a book because that's what, you know, that's the page count a publisher says we need to stick to.
Right.
For me, it's just kind of like, how can we make this a work of art? And if I can focus on it as a collector's item, work of art, beautiful illustrations all through, then most likely there's going to be other people like that who want the same thing. And sure enough, there are, you know. Mm-hmm. There's the complainers who are like, I can't believe this is only half the story and it's $25. You know, it's like, well, you can read it for free online, you know, so.
Yeah, bringing that up, it is worth it just to get, because this especially the cloth bound books is really beautifully put together. It's a handsome book.
Well, and I kind of agree with you. I like the physical. Yeah. I go to Captain Bangles every often I can and pick up my comic books and read through them. And the ones that, you know, I can upload to Comixology, like, oh yeah, put in the code. Yeah, I can read it on my phone, whatever. But I like having the physical in the hand.
Yeah, me too. I always tell people, it's like, you know, people who collect Van Gogh paintings, they're not going to be satisfied for a print or a digital version. They want the Van Gogh, you know? Mm-hmm. Or if you like 3D sculpture, you know, maquettes, like a Hellboy maquette. You're not going to be happy with the 3D model in your computer that you can rotate. Yeah. You want the maquette.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, so that's the way I look at it anyway. I'm sure, you know, this generation has grown up with a lot of digital stuff, but people are still people. They still want to collect things and fill up storage units with stuff.
Yeah.
It's just not, that's not going to change, you know, I don't think.
I think he's talking about you, Alex.
He never broke eye contact. I don't know if it's something I said or a sign around my neck.
Mega Man 2 stuff.
Two storage units. That's what I'm up to now. One by the interstate and then one of...
I think at one point... Yeah, at one point, Alex just went to, like, ThinkGeek.com and said, I'll have one of everything, please.
But it has to have Mega Man.
And they just started shipping it. Not even just Mega Man.
They signed me a wrap. Yeah. It's, I can just call. I don't even have to, go to the website anymore.
Yeah,
Alex,
sometimes they call me.
They call him. They're like, hey, we got a new, thing. You know,
right,
he's like, sure. He's like, a thing? Okay.
Ship it to my storage unit.
It's not even like, do you want it? It's like, we're shipping you this.
It'll be really bad if you find yourself in a Ron Swanson situation where you go up to them and you're like, you may think that I am just ordering some Mega Man stuff, but you don't understand. I want every Mega Man. That is what I want. I want all of it. You're going to be there, Alex.
All the Mega swag.
Give me everything.
So this may be an obvious question, but do you feel like the creative product is the end goal and the pay you get when you produce the product is the means to the end? So like you publish a single copy of your book, it sells for $25. Is that the means to the end that the book's published for you, I guess this is kind of a soul searching question, but maybe you feel like obviously you have to live your human being. It's good to make money off of your passion. Are you mostly in for it just so you can be like, this is my book I made. This is what I want to make. I love this.
Yeah.
Or is it, I love doing this and it just happens to also pay the bills.
I think it's a little bit of both, you know, because when I, especially after working in art for 20 years, a lot of different careers on big movies, you know, that people, like, I'm proud of some of these movies and stuff, but I would always just feel like, you know, if this is it, then I'm going to be like, yay, I worked on Kung Fu Panda 2, 1, 2, and 3, you know, cool. But, you know, it's not really me. It's just like any other job kind of thing. And, it was just never really fulfilling, you know, whereas when I started putting out my own stuff and people would respond to it, that was so much more fulfilling. And And so, you know, yeah, it's like I have finally kind of gotten to this point to where it's like doing the thing I love to do is actually paying the bills. And, but yeah, I'm sorry, I'm going on and on and on. But you know, just having I always thought having a collection of books on the bookshelf that could, at the end of my life, that say, these are all the different things that are important to me in some way, you know? It's like,
or these are the things I did.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not just like, I worked on that commercial or that movie. It's like, these are my things. My stamp is on this, right. You know? It's 100% me. So, yeah. And, you know, getting the paycheck is rewarding, you know? But I was doing this even without the paycheck for years and years and years, you know? So, I mean, for 20 years, I was trying to figure out I was making stuff, you know? I always tell people, you have to have a personal project in order to, you know, break through anything and something to succeed. You kind of have to have this personal project that's driving you. And, you know, before it was the comics, it was animation. I was trying to do this as an animated movie. And I worked on it for like 7 years. I learned how to animate while doing it. And it was just kind of like this thing that I was obsessed with, you know, because it was my thing, you know. And then I realized it would take me 30 years to finish it. So I decided to do it as a book, and it was a great decision because now people actually can see it.
So are you ever thinking about going back to maybe trying to animate it?
Not really. I feel like my desire for animation has just kind of disappeared again. Okay. Because I just want to produce the property. I just want to produce the content. Mm-hmm. Like if someone were to say, hey, we want to make this into a movie, I'd be like, great, go for it. Yeah. I don't want to have anything to do with it. I want to see what you're doing, but I don't want to be involved, you know? And it's probably just because I worked in Hollywood for so long. It's like, it's just a bunch of crap. I don't care what, you know?
So it's got to be really empowering to have that idea and you can put it in the book compared to, well, I mostly finished this animation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a completely different thing because the animation, I would have to say, okay, Joe, you need to sit down and on this couch and you have to watch this. Oh wait, the sound's not working here. Let me plug. Okay. This scene's not finished, but just pretend that, okay, now let me fast forward to this part.
I've got the animatics storyboard.
And they're like, they get done and they're like, I don't, okay, I guess. Yeah. You know,
so that happened.
Like, I spent 7 years working on that, you know, it's like, and I only showed it to one person, you know. I mean, sure, I could have, you know, started doing the YouTube route with it, you know, but I can't spend 7 years to work on a YouTube video that lasts 5 minutes. You know, it's not going to.
Oh, that's
not going to.
The reason why we're an audio podcast instead of video. I was like, no, I can't do the.
Yeah.
Some people are really good at video editing. I'm not one of them.
Yeah. So
do you think? It sounded to me, and maybe this is just filtering through my personality and who I am, but it sounded to me that you more enjoyed the single than doing the books here. Mm-hmm. because you get to do it.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, with Kung Fu Panda, you were part of a team.
Yeah.
And so when it was all said and done, like right here, you know, Jason Brubaker, right?
Yeah.
There, bam.
Yeah.
But in Kung Fu Panda, you're like, wait,
yeah.
here comes, there's my name. Oh, and now it's gone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, do you think that's a drive for you? Do you think that really ties into it, or?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I really enjoy doing everything, you know? So it's not as much about having my name on. In fact, Sithra, I almost wanted to not have my name on the cover. And I don't know why. It was after I finished Remind, and again, my soul was destroyed. And so I was like, keep going back to that. But, I felt like I'm with the animation, I was just like, I'm going to do this all myself. I want to learn to do it and do it all myself. And it's because of the control.
Right.
I think that's more than anything is the control. In Kung Fu Panda, you know, they would give you a scene and you'd be like, oh, this is neat. I got this idea for it. And you start working on it and it'd be beautiful, amazing. And then they'd be like, and no. And let's see, his version. And it's like, you know, it's like just stupid. So not saying, you know, I'm comparing it. There was amazing artists there, but it just didn't ever seem like it was what you invested in trying to put. Right. And like, yes, there's my art in it and stuff. But, you know, it's like, I don't feel like it's me. I don't feel like it's, I would never do that in my free time on my own.
Would you consider perhaps any kind of collaborative effort with another artist, which doesn't dilute as much as like being in a huge ensemble of collaborators?
Even that's tricky. You know, I kind of work with Jeremy Barlow, but I'm still in control. I'm telling him what to do, and then I can throw out all of his edits at the end of the day. And I don't, but because he's really good. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even just, I guess for me, it's just I have so many stories already that I'm excited about.
Right.
And if it's not exciting, then it's just a job, you know? And so I'm fighting all the time to just always keep the excitement in what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the times you see, like, my stuff will change from book to book. And it's because I want to keep it fresh and exciting for myself, not just for my audience, but because if I'm not experimenting with this and cracking some code, then it kind of and I'm doing the same thing over and over and over for 5 years, then I'm kind of like, it's the same thing I was doing before, you know, it's the same as just at a career. And for example, like my career, like I kept switching my career in art because I would get bored of it every 5 years. So I did storyboards, and I was just completely tired of it after a while, and jumped into doing animation for Motion Design Studios. Did that for about 5 years, and then was like, I don't want to do After Effects anymore, animation anymore, and I jumped into DreamWorks, and I did VizDev, you know? And so it's just... And then after that, I was like, how could I get tired of doing VizDev at DreamWorks? But sure enough, I did. You know, it's like, because I've done it. I've done it every day for this many years. So I worry that I'll get bored of working on my own stories, too. It's, I've been working on them for more than 5 years, though, and I'm not bored. And I think it's because I can finish a story, get done with it, and start a new story, and it's a whole different idea, and I can use different art concepts with it. And like my next one, I want to do it all in black and white, you know?
Oh, really? That's interesting.
So for me, it's just, it's got to be fun and exciting. Otherwise, I should just go get a job and do what someone else wants me to do. Because it's too like soul crushing to to invest all this time if it's not fun, you know?
Yeah,
like,
certainly.
Like it always starts out as a hobby, you know? I was just somewhere, I was talking about this the other day. It's like... You know, people don't complain about snowboarding being taking up too much of their time, you know, like, oh, I got to go snowboard again. This sucks. You know, oh, I need to buy a new board. You know, it's just, it's a hobby. It's like you enjoy putting that time into it, you know? And so I do, even though it pays the bills, I really, I'm always fighting and thinking about how I can keep this fun for me, you know, and as I'm going into the next story, you know? I don't know why I went there. Did you guys ask a question about that?
Well, it seems pretty clear that
you answer your question.
About, yes, certainly. Yes, you want to have your identity unadulterated.
Yeah,
The control, and that seems like that's really common among creative minds.
Yeah,
like some can jump into the common pool and do shared universes and everything like that, and kind of work around that.
Yeah. But,
yeah, I mean,
and I think it goes back to the people that I admired when I was young. You know, it was like the newspaper comic strip people. That was one person doing it. You know, or maybe a small group. The comic artists, you know, one person kind of. You know, I guess it's a little different.
That is the thing about like comic books is usually you do have the artist and the storyteller. It's really nice in your case where you can you are actually good at both.
Yeah,
there is a few in the industry that can do it in like the big name brand.
Bill Watson, Calvin Hobbes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So well, even Jim Jones and
Garfield.
Oh no,
Jim Davis, Jones.
That's Garfield.
Looney Tunes, right?
Looney Tunes, oh, okay.
Jim Jones, no.
That's DC. That is Chuck.
Oh,
Chuck Jones.
Chuck Jones. Chuck Jones, I apologize.
Or Jim Jones, he's a...
Jim Jones, he's a great guy.
He worked on cartoons.
Yeah, everyone loves him. You mean by Jim Jones?
DC? Characters. No.
Let's just go DC.
Yeah. Yeah, he worked DC.
Yeah, Jimmy Jones, he's the best.
So some of the people you mentioned at first, I mean, not Garfield, but... But like The Far Side and Calvin and Hobbes, like I don't know. It was part of my childhood was feeling the loss of those comics, of those artists, because they just said, well, I think I feel like I'm stagnating and I'm just going to stop doing this.
Yeah.
And, you know, you guys can do what you want. Do you feel like that's something that could happen in your future? Like you've got these five stories. Once you tell them, you think maybe you'll just stop, or do you think stories are going to come? Or
I can't. Yes, that's a hard one for me to know. And I guess I ask myself that question a lot. Like, will I burn out if I'm doing exactly what I want to do? Mm-hmm. You know, if I wake up in the morning, I want to work on my thing. Well, what happens if I work on my thing for 10 years? Will I not care about working on anything? Right. You know, like, and I don't know that.
But character.
Yeah. I feel, though, in a way that the reason those guys' comics were so powerful and influential is because they knew when to stop.
Right.
You know, they didn't just keep
going on forever. And like,
yeah. And it's kind of like no one cares about it, you know? Yeah. Like, I mean, kids probably do, but...
All those people who still subscribe to the paper.
Yeah.
I think...
I mean, you open up a paper and it's all legacy comics now. It's all stuff that has been handed down for generations and generations. And yeah, reruns of Peanuts and...
Yeah.
Simpsons.
Oh, like, what's going on?
Simpsons. I don't know anyone who's watching Simpsons right now.
I don't know. They just did a big old thing where they did a live Q&A at the end of their last show.
By real people or not?
Like, people called in and Homer answered questions.
Was it
during the credits? Apparently, he supports Bernie Sanders. He likes his chicken, and he thinks he should be called the Colonel.
Oh, okay. So people are watching The Simpsons. So
like the last time I watched Garfield read a Garfield was someone took Garfield out of all the Garfield comics and it was just John Arbuckle talking to himself. And they were really dark and like it put this whole other facet to the comic, and like that I went through and I read them all.
Yeah.
Like, it took me like 6 months, but it's
at least Garfield without Garfield.
Without Garfield. Yeah. And it was amazing, but like you put Garfield back in there and it's like
I get it.
Actually, wait,
and he does like pizza or lasagna.
Yeah.
John Arbuckle. I didn't realize that was the guy's name.
John Arbuckle.
Okay.
Garfield-Garfield.net.
Yeah.
Boom.
That's that. Would you want to add anything else? Or?
If you guys could support my campaign.
All right. No, and that's definitely it's going to be in the show notes. With that,
I was just looking at the because when Bill said that you're going to be on, that name sounds really familiar because of high school or whatever. But I googled you and stuff, and like I just saw the cover, and I was like, it's a comic book, and I'm not really a comic book guy, but I am kind of a web comic guy. I've been following Girl Genius for the past like 4 or 5 years now.
Oh, okay.
And I just while we were talking here, I just looked up Cythra, and now I'm gonna have to on the web
on Webtoons. Okay.
Webtoons, yeah. And now I think I might be hooked. So
the cat is awesome.
The what?
The cat is awesome. I love the cat.
Yeah. So this cat, like people like him so much in Remind that I figured he's kind of my logo too, the CTC logo.
Oh yeah, there you go.
And I figured I would just use him as an actor, and he would be playing different roles in different stories. So every one of my stories has this cat. He's just a different personality.
So it's kind of like the Kevin Smith universe. You got like the common theme amongst all the things. Even if he's not the same character, he's the same actor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I noticed that this here kind of looked like Vampire the Masquerade, the artwork. That they had in there. This one reminds me of
reminds you of it?
It reminds me of like the artwork from some of the old clan books from Vampire the Masquerade.
I did actually work for Vampire the Masquerade. That was my first job.
So this is a question I wanted to ask. I was trying to figure out how to get it in there. So did you work on the Book of Nod?
No. I worked on A World of Darkness, Prince's Primer. I don't know what other ones. There was like five books.
Okay. Yeah, because to me, that that and the perspective and just the way her face is drawn and everything on the Remind cover there is it's really kind of reminds me of some of the artwork from that old World of Darkness.
The stuff I did was books. A lot different because I would I would get my friends to pose and I would put a big bright light on them and black backdrop and then I would like trace them with a light table and airbrush.
Did you,
so it was really
did you draw
hyper...
in black and then like draw in like have a black background and a white like draw in white?
I would put hang like a black backdrop and then have a spotlight so that just the real hot parts were illuminated. And then, you know, it was before I had digital cameras. And this was 20 years ago, you know. And then I would go process the film and then blow it up on a photocopier and then light table it, you know, and then ink it and then airbrush over that. So they're really neat looking pieces. Some of them are anyway. Yeah. So it was that was cool. I mean, they paid me like $25 for a piece. It was just such a, it's so like, wow, I can't believe that was my first job. And like full pages were like $100, you know, and I worked on that forever, you know?
Right. So you're like, that was like 50 cents an hour.
Yeah. It was funny, the guy who hired me actually called me up after I moved to LA and he was like, hey, can you get me a job there? I was like, wow, I must have made it.
There you go. Guess that was the best way to find out.
Yeah.
I'm way in on that one still. Well, besides those friends that could just call me, hey, can you give me a job? I don't even know if there's any openings.
Yeah, I got that a lot at DreamWorks and I'm like, this is such a corporate company that there's no way I could get you a job. Like, you have to go through some whole, you know, room full of random people.
Yeah.
I don't even know how I got in here.
I'll give you the website. I'm sure if you send your email or your resume to somebody, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. I can give you a contact who's responsible for the contacts of this contact or something.
Yeah.
You know?
To verify if you're the seventh child of a seventh child.
Yeah,
that's a different company. That's Disney. Oh wait, they're the same company now.
Yeah.
So we'll wrap things up. We have an event. We'll just wrap it up with the event because it's been a great podcast. But the event is that we're going to be at is going to be at Carmike Pine Ridge 10 at 4355 Yellowstone Avenue. Next Thursday, the 26th of May at 7 p.m. to watch X-Men.
Nice.
Yeah. Yes.
X-Men.
It's going to be in the big D theater. It's going to be lots of awesomeness. We're going to have more prizes and give away and ask questions. And
there's it's always a lot of fun when you're asking questions.
I know.
And the people in the back are all like, oh, that's such an easy question. Well, why didn't you go up there? You could be getting this prize.
We usually have more prizes than people. And
yeah.
Although, hopefully, a lot of people. I know the reviews are not the best, but I'm extremely excited about X-Men.
Yeah, I haven't been hearing good
reviews. I don't listen to reviews. I think people who do reviews are paid to say bad things about things that I love, and so I just don't listen to
except
reviews.
For us. Yeah. We review it, we're not paid.
Well, we're not. I think it's just
from the heart.
It's for us, it's just like, I mean, we're not really officially like a reviewing it, we're just kind of talking. I think there's a difference. I really do.
It's the Ratatouille sort of thing.
We're just kind of sitting around talking about it. I don't think we're reviewing anything.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm a huge hypocrite. Thank you for pointing that out. I'm gonna have to. I'll go to the X-Men, but I'm not going to talk about it afterwards.
Okay. No. Don't worry. We'll just stick a mic in front of you, and you can... If you happen to say
I'll just breathe heavily.
But it's going to be good.
Yes.
It's going to be good. I feel it in my gut.
Lots of fun.
Yeah.
And there's still tickets, because I bought them yesterday.
That's right.
So
I need to...
Procrastinating.
Right. I need to
I got mine a week ago.
Really? Oh, yeah. You mentioned that.
Well, okay. Earlier this week. Whatever.
What, Alex, did you get yours?
Yeah. I got them.
Wow.
I got two.
Okay. Yeah, I'm behind.
I even got Joe's his ticket, too.
Yeah.
I got to get a hold of him, actually.
Oh, man. Yeah, I need to head over there. I don't want to be shut out.
It's happened. It happened with Civil War. Had people going like, I was going to get my ticket, and they were none.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's a good movie. So I enjoyed it.
I did too.
Yeah, Sansa Stark. You need to be a good gene.
It's quite the review you've given there.
Yeah.
Very in-depth and detailed. Good Thank movie. You for that review.
Yeah. Got my approval. Check mark.
So this is also the other thing. I did not prepare you for this. I'm sorry about that.
We're never prepared for this.
We're not even prepared for it. None We've us, done it 200 times.
No, I've done it like 10.
That, yes. But we have famous last words. No, you're already like, great. There's been nothings. Then there's been repeats from something.
Some mic drops.
Yeah.
My famous last word, I'm just going to clear my throat. It's,
all right.
It's not even a word.
So we'll start around. Alex, you have a famous...
Oh, I just start with me.
Ted.
Happy 205. Ah, that's not the right one. Just go, Ted.
Omnibus.
That was it? Oh, that was mine right there.